This is Queer Voices.
You know, we don't talk a lot about the good old days, unless Ray Hill's on here. But I thought it would be really interesting to hear about some of the things that went on in the earlier days, in the 80s, the late 70s, the early 80s, here in Houston, the GLBT community. And I think this is really apropos because we have an upcoming election where Hero's on the ballot. And certainly Houston, along with America, has progressed a lot in our rights, and things are better. And yes, there's marriage equality, yet we still don't have equality dealing with being fired or public accommodations. In fact, we're going to talk about the gas lamp bar in Midtown that used to be a gay bar, the BRB, how there's allegations there of being racist. So Larry Bonnaris is with us, and Larry used to be on this show, actually the previous show, Wildenstein, a lot when Ray Hill was doing the show. And I want to welcome you here. What are you doing here in Houston?
Thank you for having me. First, let me congratulate you guys for keeping this consistent about getting the message out to the community. I haven't been here in 30 years, but it's just wonderful to be back. And I know what we tried to do in the early days. This was the source of information for the public outside, really, not just Montrose, but citywide, where people were pretty much still in the closet, very difficult to come out in the early 70s. We had a hateful police department who was pretty much run by the Ku Klux Klan, in my opinion. And it was difficult. And so this was the voice of reason across the city. And I thank you and your staff for keeping that alive.
Well, yes, and we're very lucky that KPFT still allows us to do this show. But, you know, I don't know if people know about how the bars used to be raided, how people's lives were destroyed if their name got out in public because, you know, back then you got fired.
That's one of the reasons why I'm here. I came to salute. They're doing a movie, The Trouble with Ray, which I thought was an apropos name for the title for the movie, to salute Ray Hill for him having the audacity to stand up for not only our rights, but feeling that the police were constantly raiding Mary's in particular. Raiding numbers. I remember standing in the door with him and Bev one night waiting for the police to come. So we'd be the first ones to be arrested. And this is the kind of guy that, also remember meeting Ray, on Westheimer and saying to him, "You're doing this all wrong."
Yes.
And he said, "Well, you come show me how to do it." And I thought, I will. And about 8 years later, I created the first gay pride parade in Houston and was so happy that 10,000 people showed up and getting the permit from the police department. And I said, "Now you got it. This is the way you do it. You bring the masses in." But he always had the concept of inclusiveness. He worried about women and minorities and transsexuals
and Ray came along with that too. You know, I mean, it's a journey for all of us.
Correct.
It's a journey for all of us. And I mean, you know, it certainly was a journey for me with transgendered people. Mm-hmm. You know, we learn and get to know, like people like Phyllis Fry, which had its wonderful article in the New York Times. But yes, we learn from that. What was your relationship with Ray?
My relationship from day one was admiration for the way he stood up. I didn't agree with some of his tactics, but nobody did. But after we became friends, I admired him for the town meeting one where we came together as a community. We could see who was who. I admired him particularly for the No on 6 dinner that we had in Houston where we came together and we were able to meet people like Harvey Milk and Troy Perry, Dale Martin. They were real live people. And after that network was put together and I watched Ray maneuver during the first March on Washington meeting here in, at the University of Houston and going from group to group and then talking to the minority groups. And we almost didn't have a march because the People of Color Caucus was pulling out. And Ray said, "You got to deal with this." And I went in and negotiated with them and said, "No, people of color and women will lead the march." And that put them back in the segment of wanting to participate in the march. I even had a fight with my boyfriend who had to be Anglo at the time and didn't speak to me for 2 days. Why did the people of color have to be in the front? And we were trying to make a statement about inclusiveness because this was really a white gay male world. It wasn't inclusive of transsexuals. It certainly wasn't inclusive of African Americans and Latinos. And to me, this is a community because, and it's a community that's together because the people that laid a foundation for inclusiveness like Ray Hill.
Well, and you talked about maneuvering, which reminded me of the time that you, me, and Ray went to San Francisco to attend the InterPride conference. And as we're going to the opening plenary meeting, you and Ray were arguing about where to sit in the audience. And to me, I had no concept of what you're arguing about. And Ray said, you know, it depends on where you sit. You can control the meeting.
That's correct.
And so, yes, I've learned that. Yes. I've learned that over the years.
And not only that, but you have to realize that, you know, this was the baby steps in the movement because we had already experienced how the West Coast felt about the East Coast. And then bringing them here into Houston to make them mellow out and realize we had to have this march. And God knows if we hadn't had that march and we put the faces with the name, the network that helped us to the AIDS crisis wouldn't have been there. And so it was baby steps that we had to take, and we were always on the same page about who's going to control the meeting and how it's going to maneuver and what we want to come out with it. So we always went into a meeting with an agenda.
Right, right, right. Well, you were very much involved in both Pride and the caucus, and even though they were separate organizations, they were sort of the same in many ways because of the same leadership.
Well, it was the same leadership, and remember, I served with Steve Shiflett for 2 years, assuming that it would be my turn to run for president of GPC. And when he said, no, I'm seeking a third term, I said, oh, no, you're not, because I want my opportunity to show what people of color can do in that seat. And we ran against one another, and one of the largest turnout, 400 and something people turned out, had a line around the block to vote for president. They flew people in from all over. I lost by 6 or 7 votes. And I was, you know, I took it very hard, but it gave me time to develop the parade, which was a dream of mine, and then Pride Week, which lasted back in those days for 12 days. And that was just a vision that I had, and it gave me time to work on that. So when Steve stepped down and people said, well, you're going to run, I said, no, I'm going to respect Lee Harrington's opportunity to be president, and then I'll come back in. But that gave me 2 years to work on my two dreams, which was the parade and Pride Week, and then become president of GPC. Then I had the Pride Parade, I had GPC, I had a full-time job, I was on the board of the National Gay Task Force, I was running for the first openly gay person from Texas to be a delegate to the National Democratic Convention, and I was so involved in the community, but you're right, everything crossed over, and I had great people to support me, like Terry Harris and Marion Coleman and a bunch of other people, yourself. And just people that had your back all the time.
Well, and I remember you, me, and Ray talking at one time, and you had this dream of doing a night parade in Houston.
Oh, yes.
And
yes.
And the time
it was
just
too hot in the daytime.
Yes, yes, yes. And it wasn't until 1997 that we actually were able to do that.
Correct.
And I don't think very many people remember that you actually thought about that way ahead of it.
Well, it was really too hot in the daytime. What I was pleased with in terms of getting the permit, that was Justin Robinson Jr., who happened to be a councilman that helped us through that process, because the police department wasn't really willing to give us the permit. I took some personal insults with those meetings with Chief Bankston, and Jim McCann was mayor, and it was a difficult time. It wasn't, you know, you had Frank Mann in office who was calling us the odd wad and using queer when it wasn't complimentary like it is today because it's our word, it's not theirs. And so it was my dream to have a parade, and how it stemmed was I brought my baby sister from New Orleans here to see the Foley's parade, and we're standing on the sidewalk, and after the third float went by, she said, this is boring.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, if I could get the gay community to do a parade, we could have, you know, floats and throwing beads, and so I wanted it to be the first celebration in the country rather than
protest. And that's what it turned out to be.
And
it took a while to do it, but I also have to say, by the time I took over, and it was sort of thrown in my lap, a lot of those problems were solved. We were able to get the permit every year.
Mm-hmm.
We were able to, and in the relationship I had with the police department, and back then it was traffic and transportation, those people didn't even want to talk to me because there was no problems.
Correct.
But a lot of that was because of the institutions that you and your group of people helped build.
And it was also the personal relationship we formed in the police department.
Yes,
I remember lying and saying that we wanted to hang, we couldn't hang the banners for the Pink Triangle. We had to get the energy company to let us hang American flags on a post the first year of the parade. And I lied and said it was the West Diamond Art Festival people that wanted to put this up before the 4th of July. And I became good friends with two cops that were patrolling behind us how we hung the flag. So one of them looked at me and said, "That guy keeps rolling around the block. I think he's looking at you." And I said, "No, he's looking at you." And we laughed. And we formed a friendship. I was later on going from a bar one night, Dirty Sally's, and a police car pulled up behind me with the sirens on, and he pulled me on the side of the road. He said, "Get out of the car," over the microphone. And then he walked up to me. He was two guys messing with me, you know. But you form these personal relationships.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And part of that was, you know, yes, there's a whole activism and the protest part of our community. But there's also the people that have to work within the system and be able to produce those things and produce them on a level that makes the city proud.
Correct.
And that's exactly where we're able to
take the parade. Well, that's the reason why I took the insults from the police chief, because I wanted that permit. And it was important for us to display, for the whole world to see, that we wanted to celebrate our sexual orientation and not protest that. And to see those floats go down, it sent two police cars down, and we had 10,000 people. And he told us, "You could only have one lane of West Diamond." Well, Mary's float was enough to take up the whole thing. I was redirecting buses to the side street, so we had, by the time we got down to that corridor, the crowd was too big. They had taken up the entire street, so it turned out really beautifully.
Well, and the tradition continues.
Yes.
And even though I have some problems with the leadership, there's still a parade every year, and it's gotten bigger.
Well, let me tell you, I was really, 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 I particularly came here this year to see what the parade would be like downtown. Because my feeling is that you have to feed the businesses, the bar businesses, in order to get the money. And I did that all those years to keep them informed. They put nice floats in the parade and made the parade. But I was really impressed with the turnout. Of course, we had the gay marriage thing, with the crowds at the festival, with the quality of everything that went on. It was just absolutely spectacular. And I left here and said, because your mayor and I have had several discussions about moving that parade downtown, and I was adamantly against it, but I salute those individuals.
And I was too, but I do, you know, yes, it provides a better sort of stage, certainly the festival. The festival, there was, you know, I will give him credit for that. There's too many people at the festival.
They need more food and drink.
And you got to give them, you know, you got to give them time. That was the first
year.
Correct. I'm sure they didn't expect that much. But we're talking.
And my critique of the parade is you've got to find some really nice floats to, you know, you got to manage it to a sense that, not because you called in and you're number five, that you're number five on the list to parade. You've got to look at this as a presentation and fill in the spots that are a little weaker on presentation. So that would be my only critique, having created a parade and wanting to be part of it.
Well, but, you know, you're also from New Orleans.
Yeah.
It's an art.
Yes, it is.
You know, there's parades, you know, by somebody just clicking their fingers.
That's
there's parades.
Correct.
And actually, this is a good transition. We're talking to Larry Bonnaries, who was one of the really founders members and very active in the early days here of Houston. You're from New Orleans, and then you went back to New Orleans about 30 years ago.
Right. But I also, whenever, you know, I was always used my French pronunciation, which is Bonnaries.
Go ahead.
But in New Orleans, everybody knows me as Bagnaris. And when I ran for public office, my cousin told me, "You're going to use Bonnaries, and you're going to use the French pronunciation. You're going to lose 89 percentage points." So I turned out to be a Bagnaris. So I don't want to confuse anybody. I sold out, and I still lost.
So tell me about the community in New Orleans, and you've lived in both cities. You know, there's definitely a difference. I mean, Houston and New Orleans probably couldn't be different cities. I mean, there's so much difference. I mean, there's so much culture in New Orleans and tradition. And Houston, it's like if something's 2 years old, we tear it down and we rebuild it. And then, of course, you went through Katrina, which was, it was the storm was bad enough, but the levees failed because of the Corps of Engineers, didn't really keep the levees up. So how did our community fare?
Well, you know, I have to say thank you to Houston, because you took us in. My two best friends, Raymond and David, we've been friends 40 plus years. They've been together as partners 40 plus years. They took me into their home, and you did that all over the city. And then the organization stepped up to provide clothing and making sure everybody had bus fare and making sure they had a little funds in their pocket, the Montrose Conference Center. So I want to thank even some of the bars took in some of our bartenders.
Yes.
I thought I'd be gone for 3 months. Well, I got a call saying if I wasn't back by September the 27th, I wouldn't have a job. So I piled my stuff back in my car and went back to New Orleans. And it's interesting because the first thing on my mind was to get the bars back in order. Because with the bars, then the community can come home, and while you're working on your house, you can have a drink. So I got back September the 28th. The bars were open by October the 1st. I was arguing with the mayor about why we couldn't keep the bars open 24 hours. He said, "Have you been on Bourbon Street? You got FEMA workers, you got day laborers that don't speak English, you've got people from corporate America and FEMA. It's all men, and nobody knows what's going on." I thought, well, that's a great idea, but I didn't. He was looking at it a different perspective. He said, with all this mixing and going on, and you add alcohol to that, it's not possible. So I negotiated a deal with the district police department that if you're in the bar by midnight when all the other bars close, in the gay bars you could stay until 6 o'clock in the morning and we'll let you out. So the gay bars were very happy. We went from that to our Halloween, which is a very big function and fundraiser in the city. People come from all over the world now to attend Halloween in New Orleans, which is a fundraiser for Lazarus House. We left that, went to the holiday spirit. Nobody really wanted a Mardi Gras, but we needed Mardi Gras for economic reasons. And most people don't realize that all that stuff is paid for a year in advance. You got your medallions, you've got your beads with your crew's name on it. In the case of the gay crews, they were all flooded out because all their costumes were in dens that were underwater. But they still went on and put their balls on. We went from that to the Easter season, which is a fundraiser for the Grand Marshals to decide what charity it goes to. We went from that to the festivals, the French Quarter Festival, Jazz Festival, and everything was coming off just on time. And then we went from that to 4th of July, where we celebrated our independence, and we could see us building and growing. We could see people coming in and helping us. The churches helped us a lot. As a matter of fact, I've got a shout out to Dallas. The Dallas MCC gave us $10,000 to reincorporate our community center there, which was important for our youth that were coming back, born with their family. Then we went into the Southern Decadent Spirit, which lasts for a month because they're fundraising for another agency, and you're back to Halloween. So if you like costume and you like partying and you do hair or you do florists, New Orleans is the place for you to be. I'm recruiting.
So has the community rebuilt in the sense that people come back? Is our population still there?
The population in the gay community has changed a little, but it's still that flux of all those holidays and all these fundraisers set around these holidays to feed the services in the community. So every holiday celebration, I know everybody comes to New Orleans and they think we're just having a party. You know, you just dumped. The people from Houston were very generous. We just spent 5 days in New Orleans with Southern Decadence. We racked in $200 million in tourist funds. We had 190,000 people there. But that's all gone to the fundraisers we put on, raised about $40,000 for some of our social benefit organizations, for gay marriage, for the youth center. And so everything that we do in terms of socializing and partying has an end to it, which is to raise funds to build a community. And that's what that's done for year in and year out. And most of the community that came back, the people that were involved in those organizations had to come back because they, just like I did with my job, your job is to make sure this thing goes on.
Sure.
And so they came back. But we're getting a lot of yuppies and getting a lot of young people. I found it strange that y'all used the word queer here. I fought that word for so long, and I found out that this is what my community, particularly young community, is using. I had to go to a seminar to buy in, so I bought into this. The LGBT queer community, I'm comfortable with it now.
Well, and originally the name of this show, you know, was Wildenstein, and then that went away, and then we started a new one called Lesbian and Gay Voices. And then, to be more inclusive, instead of, you know, naming everything, I decided to go with Queer Voices with consulting everybody who was involved, not a single complaint.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's...
It took New York City at the community center at an all-day function where I get in with these young people are saying, it's not your business what I do with my body or what I look like. Worry about yourself. That individuality that Ray Hill has always had, I'm going to do it my way regardless.
So you've been through a lot of history of our community, and the fact that we have, you know, we still have discrimination, no two ways about it. But things have changed a lot for our lives.
Oh, there's no doubt about it. I mean, things are much better. It's much better across the country. One of those inner voices keep telling me that I'm back to the 80s where we were before with Hero. When a religious right takes on an issue and turns it into a bathroom issue, where we're really talking about saving somebody's employment, which puts a roof over your head, pays the light and gas bill, pays for the gas in your car, feed your children or whatever, and they turn it into a bathroom bill, they're looking for something filthy. And usually that's their method of doing things. They're destroying Africa right now because they're going all over Africa showing films of pornography saying this is what gay people do and this is what they want to do with your children. So I hear the same voices from Anita Bryant. We're a community that was communists in the 40s and 50s, child molesters in the 60s and the 70s, then disease written in the 90s. And you just have to, I believe there's confrontation, education, legislation. We've been through the legislation part, but we're going to have brush fires to put out. And I think this is one of these brush fires.
Larry Ibanez-Reese, who has been very much involved in the early part of Houston GLBT rights, now lives in New Orleans. He is a commissioner of human rights in New Orleans, and it was great talking to you and learning a little bit about our history and telling us a background from where we came from. You're listening to Queer Voices.